Hush, 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 here comes the boogeyman. Don't let him come too close to you, he'll catch you if he can.
Welcome to Boggart and the Banshee, a supernatural podcast. I'm Chris, the relentlessly informative. I study ghosts, Fortiana, fashion history, and death.
And I'm Simon, Chris's worst nightmare. I study boggarts, fairies, urban legends, and the impossible.
Well, Chris, I've had some special reading this week. I found a volume from an Ohio author called A is for Arsenic. I refer, of course, to your most recent publication. Can you give us the full title?
It's A is for Arsenic, an ABC of Victorian Death.
And what I really have enjoyed about it is that in this period of relative busyness, it's a lovely book to dip into because yes. You have this rather crazy scheme of going through the alphabet and giving each letter a value according to Victorian death. So A is for arsenic, S is for shroud.
C is for crepe, yes.
L is for lich gate, for goodness sake.
Oh, yeah.
It's the kind of thing you can read a couple a day and you don't feel that you're breaking off at a wrong point. And I just want to share one of my favorite sentences that reminded me of you so much. You were talking about iced corpses, the way that you freeze corpses in the 19th century that already was a revelation for me. And I just love this Christian sentence. The sound and smell of water running off the thawing corpse is one of the lost sensory experiences of the 19th century.
Well,
how do you come up with these? Do you lean back, have a glass of wine, and just wait for the muse to ring the bell? Or
I just live in the 19th century.
I was really intrigued by this ABC approach, and I can see that it would work in other contexts. I was thinking, for example, of a Victorian book of sex, the ABC version. F is for fornication. I mean, there are lots of different themes. You could do the same with fairies. E is for elf shot, this kind of thing. Do you have any other ideas for books of this type?
Could do a sequel if I could come up with X and Z. Those were the tough ones.
I was a little bit outraged that you did X is for sexton. I thought this was rather...
What X name would you or word would you have used?
Well, I'd have found someone called Xavier who died in the 19th century.
No.
Well, I haven't got to Z yet. So what is Z or Z in your language?
It's zinc for a type of monument. It was white bronze was the trade name. And it's actually a almost pure zinc alloy. And the people who are interested in these monuments are called zincies.
I think there is something really promising here because in the internet age, we're used to reading these 3 or 4 minute articles and full books are a little bit intimidating sometimes. And so if you can break it down into these manageable, but at least when written by you, very readable sections, I would have thought that both in terms of pleasure and commercially, you would do well.
That's what I hear from people about my Haunted Ohio series as well, is like I can just dip into it. And they're just short and sweet, and I don't have to spend a lot of time focused on one story. And if I don't like that story, I move along to the next one. So, yeah, there's something good about that format.
Well, Chris, it is your turn today. We did the Philip experiment last month. What treasure have you got for us?
We're going to be talking about the supernatural in court, and this covers a lot of different themes. We have lawsuits over haunted houses. We could do a whole program on just spiritualist lawsuits or witch trials. I'm going through a little more of a variety here.
But hold on, Chris. So just to be clear, any legal case with supernatural content is game. Is that fair?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm going for ghosts in court or murders revealed by ghosts or their visitations, that sort of thing. So we'll try to cover a variety. And I have to do the disclaimer that I have not, in fact, studied law, but I've watched all episodes of Law and Order. So I'm an expert.
I confess that when I was preparing for today, I had to look up several words just because I thought I'm going to make such a fool of myself if I don't actually know what an affidavit is and this kind of thing.
Well, you ran across it probably in Treasure Island where they made their affidavit. One thing that seems to be part of ghosts in court or the supernatural in court is what's called spectral evidence. And this is a form of legal evidence based on the testimony of people who have claimed to have seen a vision or had a visitation. It's not currently in the legal rota. I don't think it's admissible anywhere, possibly
I'd like
somewhere
to try.
Else in the world. But it was, at least over here, it was used usually in connection with the Salem witch trials. That's what we always think of, where the prisoners were seen attacking people in a vision. And that was admissible in court. That was good enough to get people hanged. There was another case, though, where a fellow in Rhode Island, Thomas Cornell Jr., he was convicted of the murder of his mother using spectral evidence where his uncle said that the ghost of his sister appeared to him and said, "I am your sister, Cornell. See how I was burned with fire." And they took him to court and he was hanged.
What's the date for that, Chris?
1673.
Right. Now, I think I'm correct in saying that most of the examples that you're going to look at today come from a later period.
Yes.
So in a sense, it's spectral evidence from your favorite century, the 19th century.
Right. Most of it is. Yeah, we have a couple of 18th century cases, but most of it is 19th century. So it did persist. But of course, there was controversy about it.
Absolutely. So we're really at the very end of spectral evidence being used. And in many of these cases, the judges perhaps understandably had little patience.
Yes, exactly. Now, we talked about, you mentioned the word affidavit. And that was a really interesting facet of a lot of news reports of supernatural occurrences where people would swear in front of a justice of the peace that we saw this supernatural thing. We saw this horrible thing happen. And it's quite interesting because it's almost like the urban legend introduction of the witness whose veracity cannot be questioned. The more you have an affidavit, the more likely it is to be perhaps a tall tale.
Ah, so it's actually in reverse. You would expect an affidavit to give guarantees, but instead it's not always that way.
Yeah, and it's meant to lend weight and gravitas to these testimonies. But looking at it from the 21st century, it's a very different appearance. So do you have some examples of this sort of thing?
Absolutely, I do. The place I've most often come across affidavits, and you'll laugh, but is in connection with mermaids.
Ooh.
There was the start of an industry in mermaid bodies.
Yes.
These were the kind of bodies that Barnum would later display in New York, that would turn up in the fairs up and down the country. And of course, people who were showing these to the crowds had to give them a backstory.
Yes.
And so the typical thing was to find someone who had been on the boat or in the bay when this mermaid had been caught and who had signed off with an affidavit. So before you spent your shilling and went in, you at least had this guarantee that it had to be real. And this is where what you say about the presence of affidavits tends to point to actual problems in the evidence. However, in the early 19th century and in the mid-19th century, that also in Britain started to be a number of cases where people saw mermaids or claimed to see mermaids and they gave affidavits about them. Mm. And this is much more interesting in terms of the supernatural because here there was nothing on display. In other words, it wasn't people going into the funny house at the fair These were just a couple of fishermen on the west coast of Scotland who claimed that they had seen a woman in the sea with long and beautiful hair, this kind of thing. And so we have a number of affidavits like this. And we have one that shows you how people could cross the line, though, and that made me laugh a lot. There was a man who had put together one of these fake mermaids, and he took it out to sea in the China Sea. And when the boat was in the middle of nowhere, he got the crew drunk. He then threw this fake mermaid overboard, so it bobbed up and down in the waves. And then he got one of the sailors to fish it into the boat, and then had the entire crew, being offered a little bit more rum, sign affidavits to the effect that they had seen this mermaid swimming around in the sea around the boat for some 30 minutes. And of course, they could all, with good conscience, sign this affidavit. So, you know, affidavits were elastic. They could be used in a fairly dishonest way.
Oh, that's brilliant. I love that story.
What kind of affidavits have you come across?
Well, my favorite one is from a really wonderful case from Kentucky, Bracken County. It was a sensational case of a giant fiery devil stomping around the county, 1866. And it was described as ape-like, as tall as a house, and it had horns and hooves and claws and a tail. It was covered in shaggy fur, and it was breathing fire. And a number of witnesses appeared before justices of the peace and declared that the statements in the foregoing letter are true. The creature put in another appearance 2 years later in the same county. This one was only about 6 feet high, but it also had hooves and a tail, and it also breathed fire. And again, witnesses made affidavit to the truth of their sighting in front of a justice of the peace. And it was really convincing stuff. But shockingly, the affidavit signers do not actually exist. I looked at all these records, these county records like the census or the cemetery logs or the business directories, Masonic lodge lists, Civil War muster rolls. None of the names in the official looking affidavits can be found in any of these sources. Now, you could expect some people to slip through the cracks of history, but over a dozen, and they all witnessed these fiery, furry devils. They just poof, disappeared in a puff of sulfurous smoke.
This is the kind of thing that just couldn't have happened in British journalism in the 19th century. There would have been a national scandal. And we come back to this thing we've observed before, yeah, of the priggishness, really, of the British public in the 19th century, and say it quietly, perhaps still today. But with the mermaid affidavits, I know that these people on the west coast of Scotland existed, because if they hadn't, there would have been thundering editorials in the Times about people making things up in newspapers. But this is the wonderful difference between the British and the American press in the 19th century. So it was just a big practical joke.
Well, I'm not quite sure whether it was a practical joke or whether there's some sort of political subtext. This was right after the Civil War, and there was a lot of animosity about carpetbaggers and Reconstruction, and this was Kentucky. So I'm just not quite sure. I think there's some sort of subtext we're missing. But in any case, it was a ripping yarn, and it received pretty wide syndication. I wish it was true that there was really a fiery devil stomping around Kentucky, but we can't trust the affidavits. What can we trust in this world?
I think I'm right in saying that affidavits are still used today in Sasquatch research.
Really?
Many listeners will have heard of the American author David Palaudis. I hope I'm saying that right.
Oh, yeah, the 411.
That's right. So he wrote this series of books called Missing 411 about people who disappear, particularly in American national parks. Mm-hmm. He's also written a couple of books on Sasquatches. He connects the phenomena. When he's looking at evidence of people who claim to have seen a Sasquatch, he gets them to sign an affidavit. So there's a legal document backing up the witness account. So to some extent, this tradition continues through to the present. I should, just for the case of just in case of libel, be absolutely clear, not the tradition of making up big devils going around the wilderness, but the tradition of getting people who've had experiences to put their name in a legal way to that experience.
Right. Okay. Yes, I had no idea that still was a thing. One particular type of supernatural in court are lawsuits over haunted houses. And there's a great variety of different types of lawsuits over haunted houses. For example, a woman said that they were so badly haunted in this one house they couldn't live anymore, and that's why they weren't paying rent. Well, the county court didn't buy that. They said you have to pay rent whether you're haunted or not. In another case, some estate agents sued their tenant. They said he's prompt paying his rent, but he's damaging the value of the property by circulating stories to the effect that the house is haunted. And you could actually be sued for defamation if you claimed that a house was haunted. There was Barrett versus Associated Newspapers in 1908. The reckless publication of a report as to premises being haunted by a ghost raises a presumption of malice sufficient to support an action for damages for depreciation in the value of property, loss in rent, and expenses incurred in consequence of such publication. So who knew? One of the most famous cases of haunted houses in court is Stambovsky versus Ackley, and I hope I'm saying that first name right. This was 1991. Mr. Stambovsky signed a contract to buy a house in Nyack, New York, and he paid a down payment. But after he heard that the house was supposedly haunted, he asked for the contract to be voided and the return of his down payment, as well as damages for fraudulent misrepresentation of the property by the owner and her realtor. Now, in New York, they've got something associated with real estate law, caveat emptor. You have to do your due diligence, and it's your fault if you buy something defective. And they said he hadn't done his due diligence. But he appealed. The appellate court reversed the other trial's ruling and declared the house haunted as a matter of law. And I just love this, that the house was actually labeled haunted in a very legal and binding sense. And the legal opinion is so cleverly written. They used all these expressions from literature and from the Ghostbusters movies. And it was really funny. So I will put a link on our Facebook page to the actual case and the opinion, and people can read it for themselves. But I thought it was very funny. They were talking about the plaintiff hasn't a ghost of a chance, but we're moved by the spirit of equity.
I've come across these kind of cases often in the 19th century. I remember one from Dublin. I think it might be the Waldron family.
Oh, yeah, I've got that, but yeah.
These cases go all the way back. And I think our earliest records actually come from medieval France, where cases of rent were brought to the French Parliament in Paris with the claim, look, we don't want to continue with our contract because this property is haunted. Oh. And you can imagine it's a very easy trick to play on a landlord. If you want out of a contract, and there's a legal system that takes this seriously. And over the years I've come across, and I'm sure you have too, Chris, several poltergeist cases where the explanation for the poltergeist case was, well, yes, but the family wanted out of the contract. Yes. This is what they were trying on here. This is why stones kept coming through the windows.
And that actually has been posited as an explanation for the Amityville horror case. The people were supposedly, again, I'm skirting, you know, any legal ramifications here. The story goes that they were underwater in their rent or their mortgage. It was just too much money and they wanted out. So they fabricated a story. Whether this is true or not, I have no idea. It has been mentioned in that very, very familiar case. There's yet another one, another variation on this, though. There was a civil court case in Berlin in 1930, which raised the question of whether a residential tenant has the legal right keep a family ghost. Supposedly, a dead uncle of the Rogulski family kept haunting them. And the owner sued to evict them because A, the house is getting a reputation for being haunted and it's prejudicial to its market value. And he had two great arguments. One was that the family was carrying out some ghostly fraud for ulterior purposes of their own. And the second was, if the court found there was really a ghost, then he would say that the lease was obtained under false pretenses because they didn't disclose they had a ghostly uncle living with them. So I never could find out whether this court case was actually, you know, how it came out. But the papers said that they were hoping that the German court would settle the vexed question of whether ghosts actually exist.
The thing I most find myself wanting when I do lots of research is to know German well enough and to be able to read the Gothic alphabet to chase down stories like this. Because so often it's the German stories that are very good, but they then just die out in the British or American press where we get to read about them.
In real estate law, there seems to be a good variety of whether or not a ghost is a disclosable defect. Apparently, the Stamboski-Ackley case made it a requirement in New York State that if you have a ghost, you have to disclose it if you're selling the property. I don't think it's the case in any other state, although there's other states where you have to disclose, say, a death or a murder in a property. But it's as of now, that court case stands alone in New York State.
I mean, one of the great things about the supernatural in law cases, and perhaps this is another perspective we can give, is that, of course, ideally, the legal system is about discovering truth. And what is wonderful for someone interested in folklore and the supernatural is very often these cases actually are good at ferreting out the small but often important details in a case. And this is true, we see here with lawsuits over houses. You get lots of details that you wouldn't normally get about the house, but it's also true in other circumstances. And here, Chris, I'm going to bring in a rather unpleasant subject, if you'll let me. This is changelings. So just for anyone who's not familiar with changelings, this is a belief that's very widespread in Europe and in other parts of Euro-Asia. And the idea is that a supernatural being will come into your family and change a member of the family with, let's say, a clone. So it's something that looks like the member of the family, but isn't actually really that person. Now, typically, the supernatural being in question is a fairy. And typically, the person who is changed is a child, particularly a younger child. And in traditional societies, the first thing that is usually noticed about changelings is that someone is out of sorts. They're out of health. So imagine that you come home and you look at your two-year-old baby, and something seems a little bit different. And over the next weeks, over the next months, the baby becomes ill. Now, in modern medical terms, this means that perhaps there's some genetic issue or some underlying illness. But in traditional societies, this was a strong clue that this was not really your baby at all, but that supernatural forces, usually the fairies, had stolen your baby away. And so you needed to deal with that. Now, why does this come under the notice of the court? I'm afraid it comes under the notice of the courts for a horrible reason. In most of the parts of Europe where changeling belief was strong, there was the idea that the way you could convince the supernatural force to return your true child, or in some cases your true wife or true husband, was to mistreat the clone. And the classic version of this was you would burn the child in question. And there are some really quite horrific accounts from Britain and especially from Ireland in the 19th century of this kind of supernatural evidence being sucked into the courtroom, because every so often it would happen that a child was brutalized to the point where he or she died. And at that point, it became a matter of legal record. And the authorities, particularly in Ireland, were quite aggressive about prosecuting these kinds of cases.
But were they? I've seen some evidence that sometimes they just overlooked it, saying, well, this was their belief and there's nothing we can really do. And is it murder if it's not a human being?
I'll give you an example where exactly this happened. This is from the 1820s in an Irish parish. And what I find extraordinary is that this never came to trial. Now, we'll talk about the justification, and you've made the case a moment ago. But first, let me give you the reading. There was a boy, 7 years old, who was looked upon by his parents as suppositious. He was placed naked between three large fires in a field. The mother addressed him. The mother addressed him to this effect: "You are not my child. Go off to the good people," in other words, the fairies, "whence you came, and restore my real child to me, or you shall be burned to death." The poor child, being a cripple and unable to move, cried out, "Oh, mother dear, I am your child. Oh, mother dear, I am your loving child. Save me, save me." This affecting appeal in no way operated in these inhuman wretches, who looked on unmoved till dripping flowed from him. Yeah. And the child dies. And this was one of these cases, Chris, where you're right, that there was no action on the part of the authorities. And it's interesting, the only reckoning in this case, the local Catholic priest had the family stand up in church and berated them. So sometimes you're right, there was this, let's say, passivity on the part of the authorities because they saw this as part of the local belief system. And I think they did, as you rightly point out, have a sense that sometimes the motives were good. There was a desire to save a child and that the ceremony went wrong. And one proof of what you say is that overwhelmingly, the cases that came to court are cases that ended in the child's death. In other words, there will have been tens of other cases where the child did not die and we hear nothing more of it.
Right. And even the Bridget Cleary's murderer, her husband, he was eventually paroled, I think, and moved to Canada. So he didn't
right.
have a life sentence. He wasn't executed. Because there was some question as to, you know, well, he genuinely believed he was trying to save his wife.
For anyone who's not heard of the Bridget Cleary case, and perhaps, Chris, one day we could even just do an episode on Bridget Cleary, because such a fascinating instance of this. In 1895, a man, Patrick Cleary, came to believe that his wife, Bridget, was not really his wife, that she was a clone who had been left by the fairies. He roped in a local fairy doctor. He's someone who operates with traditional medicine, and also Bridget's family. And Bridget was put through several quite unpleasant rituals. For example, she had chicken feces thrown at her. She had her own urine, I think, thrown at her. And at the climax of one of these rituals, he emptied gasoline onto Bridget and pushed her into the fire, and she just burnt to death there in the sitting room. And yet, after this murder, the family went sheepishly home. Patrick got rid of the body, but Patrick went out to the fairy Rath, where the fairies were believed to live, because he believed that night his Bridget would be brought back to him. And this is a nice example, I think, of where the were sincere beliefs sometimes on the part of people who were carrying out these quite horrific crimes. And we have very, very detailed records just because it became a judicial fact. And I think I'm right in saying that 4 or maybe 5 people were sent to prison over this. The husband rightly got the longest sentence. But he too, he moved on. He was in prison, I think, for 10 years, and then he left and he emigrated. I didn't know it was Canada, but I remember he went to North America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he got off easy, really. And that happens today. I mean, in any case, you know, people murder their wives and they're in prison for a few years and then they're let out. I don't understand it, but there we are. And speaking of murdering wives.
What a great bridge, Chris. Congratulations. Go on.
There's a couple of interesting cases where supposedly ghosts came back to explain that they had been murdered and where to find their body. Do you know about the Red Barn murder case?
Right. I know about it by reputation. I think I've even read about it, but I would love if you could do with the Red Barn what I just did with Bridget Cleary and give an outline.
Right. Maria Martin was murdered not by her husband, but by her lover, William Corder. She'd been lured to a local barn where she expected to elope with him. And then he just disappeared and then wrote letters to her family claiming that they were married and they were living happily on the Isle of Wight, but she was too unwell to write. Well, her stepmother, Anne, had repeated dreams that she'd been murdered and buried in the Red Barn. And she persuaded her husband, Maria's father, to go and dig in a grain storage bin where he found her corpse stuffed into a sack. Corder's green kerchief was tied around the body's neck. And when he was arrested, he was running a boarding house with a new wife, and he claimed that they'd argued. But after he walked away, she shot herself with one of his pistols. An autopsy of the badly decomposed body showed that she'd been shot and possibly stabbed and strangled. He was found guilty after only 35 minutes deliberation and was sentenced to be hanged and dissected. He eventually confessed to shooting her accidentally. So there's an instance of a supernatural dream bringing someone to justice, although I've seen it suggested that the dream might not have been quite as supernatural. Maria Martin's stepmother was just a year older than Maria, Anne was, and possibly it's been suggested that she and Corder were lovers and had planned Maria's murder. And the dream started, coincidentally, just after Corder married his new wife. So, you know, were they a ruse by a jealous ex just trying to get back at Corder for not marrying her? That's one theory.
I've just looked this up and it's 1827 and Suffolk. So we're still in your beloved 19th century there.
A little bit later, lots later really, is one of the most famous ghosts on the witness stand sort of a case. And this is called the Greenbrier Ghost Case. A woman named Zona Hester Shue, she married a blacksmith named, improbably, Erasmus Stribling Trout Shue in October of 1896. And about 3 months later, she was found dead. Now, Shue just acted like his world had ended and he was draped over the corpse, wailing and crying. So no autopsy was performed. And her husband insisted on dressing her for the coffin himself. He did that immediately. And that's a huge red flag because normally the women of the community would have washed and dressed the body. She was buried the day after her death. And her mother, Mrs. Hester, claimed that Zona came and stood beside her bed, insisting that she'd been murdered by her husband. And she got enough interest from the coroner and got the body exhumed and an inquest was held. The autopsy showed that the girl's neck had been broken. She'd been choked, crushing her windpipe, and her husband was arrested. Mrs. Hester testified that her daughter had come to her in a dream and explained to her that her neck had been broken. And while the defense tried to discredit her about her daughter's ghostly visits, a lot of people believed her. He was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison, and he died a few years later.
With both these cases, I have to ask, how did the judge take this information as it was fed into his courtroom?
They took it at face value. As I say, the defense tried to discredit Mrs. Hester, for example, about you're crazy or you're deranged or you were mourning your daughter, so you imagined that she visited you. And in the final reading, I'll read a bit of her testimony. But it seemed as though the judges allowed it, whether they believed it or not. It was just part of the testimony.
I suppose trying to be rational about events like this, there are two obvious ways to explain them without any recourse to the supernatural. The first is, as you suggested, with the Red Barn case, that you might actually just have an attempt to get unknown information into the courtroom, but not be able to do it without risk to yourself in any other way.
Right.
And I suppose the second possibility is just that you have people who have a unconscious knowledge, something feels wrong, and in the end, this is articulated in a dream, the kind of thing that happens to all of us. I'm just going to give you an example from Italy of an instance of the first kind of supernatural effect in a trial where someone used the supernatural as a tool to get information on the record. And this is one that has always just blown me away. But in 1979, the most important politician in Italy, Aldo Moro, was kidnapped by a communist terrorist group, La Brigata Rossa, and he was taken. He was hidden in a safe house for the Brigata Rossa in Rome. And after a couple of months, they murdered him. There was a desperate attempt to find Aldo Moro. He wasn't then the prime minister of Italy, but he was the leader of the most important faction in the Christian Democrat Party. So he was a very, very big player. And at one point, a group in Bologna got in contact with the police and said that they had heard that Aldo Moro was being kept in a town called Gradoli, which is a town a little bit outside Rome. And in fact, this town was practically razed to the ground by police the day after. They went into every room in the town. And when they had to sign off on this, they went to this group in Bologna and they said, so where did you get the information from? Now, these individuals were already quite important Italians. And one of them, Romano Prodi, would go on to be a prime minister of Italy. And when they were asked, they claimed that they had got the information through a Ouija board.
Oh, my.
But we discovered subsequently that the Red Brigade had three safe houses in the capital, and one of them was on Via Gradoli. So a road, the Gradoli Street. Now, the usual interpretation of this is that a group in Bologna had somehow been fed information about the kidnapping and that they had used the stratagem, and it is a brilliant stratagem in a way, of sitting five people around the table, asking the spirit of a dead politician where the Moro was being kept. And the Ouija board spelt out these letters, presumably one of the people at the table directing his fingers. And so for me, it's a nice example of how the supernatural can be leveraged. It can be exploited to get information that's important into a public place without too many legal risks. Though, of course, here there's the risk of ridicule.
Yes, exactly. I don't think that would be admissible in a U.S. court. Now, you did ask me how judges viewed this, and I just ran across a case here in my files that maybe explains a little bit about that. This was in 1920, and the article about it said, a man is accused of beating his wife to death and is brought before a high tribunal for trial. Judge and jurors and audience sit and listen in respectful silence while the ghost of the dead woman testifies that she herself procured the iron bar with which she was killed, that she had intended to kill her husband with it, and that he had had great provocation to kill her. Well, that sounds like something from the 19th century. This was in 1920 in the Supreme Court of the District of Columbia. The dead woman's mother testified she'd gone to several mediums and had conversed with the ghost of her daughter and had gotten the daughter's story of what had happened. And more astonishing still, she testified that an assistant United States attorney had advised her to consult mediums. So it says you cannot blink at the conclusion that a ghost has been admitted to a court of justice in the United States.
And the judge let this go.
The judge let this go. And unfortunately, I have not found the actual case.
Okay.
I've seen this same article was syndicated widely in 1920. And I tried to find the original because the people aren't named. And if I can find somebody with a subscription to Westlaw, maybe I could find something about it.
Chris.
But in any
case, I mean, there is a difference, isn't there, in this sense that with the Red Barn, the judge is being faced with a situation that has already come into being. There is a body, it's been discovered, then comes the explanation. Whereas here, you don't have a legal fact. You just have the explanation with nothing to pin to it apart from your belief or otherwise in the Summerlands and voices from over there.
And who's to say this wasn't some lying spirit trying to get the husband off the hook?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Can I make one last appeal just before we wrap up? As we were doing this episode and we were looking at various legal cases, both Chris and I independently came across a story and we were shocked by how similar this story was. And I think we have here an urban legend in the making. And I would love to try and find a couple more examples of this because I bet they exist. The story in outline is this. A man meets a stranger and has some kind of communication, maybe a meal, maybe they sit down and fish together, maybe they have a chat. And then a couple of weeks later, the man begins to hear supernatural voices that push him towards going to the local courthouse where there's a murder trial. And often, for example, he crosses a bridge, he pays someone for the use of the road or the use of a vehicle. And all the time, the people know that he is coming. The idea is that a spirit is directing him. He gets to the courthouse, and at the courthouse, he recognizes in the face of the accused, the man he had this chance meeting with a couple of weeks before, and he is able to go on the stand and give the man an alibi because the murder for which the man is accused took place at the exact time that this gentleman was having a conversation. Now, Chris, you and I have both found examples, one from Devon, Cornwall, one relating to the English county of Worcestershire. I bet that there are others out there. And so if anyone has come across those, this is an urban legend I would love to hunt down.
Great. I hope somebody finds some more because I know there's more out there.
But Chris, let me turn over to you now. What about reading generally for this subject? Because I think as so often, we've strayed into a territory where professors have not dared, where there's very little that's written. Am I wrong about that? Or
no, I was unable to find a specific book. I mean, I'm sure there must be books on ghosts and murders. In fact, there's one actually called Murder Most Ghostly by Kurt Dalton, and he covers ghosts in connection with murder cases. And he covers like Zona Shoe's case. So there are books on ghosts and murders, but ghosts in court is a different subject. There's no one book. A couple of books I could suggest. There's one called A Demon Haunted Land, Wonder Doctors and Ghosts of the Past in Post-World War II Germany by Monica Black, which has some court cases in it.
Is it as good as it sounds?
I haven't read it. It seems to be a relatively new book. I'm not even sure if it's out yet, but I have seen notices of it.
Okay, so we'll keep our eyes peeled.
The Zona Shoe case is mentioned in The Man Who Wanted Seven Wives by Katie Lyle. And the case about Thomas Cornell, who's murdered his mother in 1673, is in a book called Killed Strangely, The Death of Rebecca Cornell by Elaine Foreman Crane. Let's see here. M.R. James's Martin's Close. And I'm fond of The Devil and Daniel Webster by Stephen Vincent Benet.
I can just add a couple to this list. One of them, though, comes from you. Andrew Lang, in his wonderful book, Cot Lane and Common Sense, has a chapter on spectral evidence and looking particularly at cases, the kind that would have fascinated him, where testimonies from dreams or visions is allowed into court. And Lang quotes in this very good chapter an earlier piece of writing that I have not read, but I would be interested to track down, by Walter Scott.
Yes, I couldn't find that.
We'll have to look for it because someone really should get all of Walter Scott's folklore and supernatural writing and put it in one place because it's spread out, it's messy, and it's good, good stuff. As far as changelings, there are quite a few articles and books there, including by myself. I written a couple couple of articles that you'll find on academia about Irish changelings and indeed Cornish changelings. I've also brought out in the Pooka series a book on Irish changelings, but specifically the children. And I should warn anyone ahead of time that it is not a pleasant read. You have,
yeah,
it's bad enough when children are physically abused, but for it to be done to children who are essentially disabled, often not able to walk, it's a very disturbing read, but there is lots and lots of folklore in there and a fair amount of fairy lore as well. So those are a couple more. At the moment, I'm helping a colleague edit a book on changelings, and I hope very much that Chris will contribute a chapter to that, but that's in the future. But if you're listening to this in 2025 or 26, it should be out or very shortly out. Chris, anything else? We seem to have...
No, I think that kind of covers the reading. I mean, I've got a couple of blog posts and we'll put those again on the Facebook page. But for the most part, and most of those have to do with more spiritualist lawsuits where, for example...
This is a different kind of thing, really, isn't it?
A fellow took up a challenge. He was supposed to get $50 if he could produce a spirit photo under these tight conditions, and he did. And the skeptics on the committee didn't want to give him the money, but they gave him the check, and then he found out the check had been stopped, the payment had been stopped, and so he sued. So it's that kind of thing.
You know, Jack London, when he was down on his luck, had this profession where instead of writing books and stories, he wrote ideas for books and stories and sold them to other authors. Jack London, a very inventive individual. And it strikes me with our podcasts that we seem to be very good at talking about areas of the supernatural and then getting to the reading section and finding that no one has ever really done justice to this area. And particularly on this business of dreams and visions, trying to tie all that together through the centuries from the Byland ghost stories that we looked at in an earlier episode, all the way through to, well, these German cases from apparently after the Second World War. I think it would be absolutely fascinating as a read.
Oh, there is one more, Hellish Nell, about Helen Duncan and the witchcraft case that where she was tried under the Fortune Teller.
I read that a couple of years ago. Yes. What's the author, Chris? I can't remember his name. He brought out a new edition of it, too.
It's by Malcolm Gaskell.
Malcolm Gaskell.
Yes. Hellish Nell, The Last of Britain's Witches. I attended a fascinating lecture called The Forensic and the Fortean by Naomi Ryan, and I'm hoping that she will bring out a book because she covered a lot of very interesting legal points to do with witchcraft cases and changeling cases and ghosts of murderers and their victims. So I couldn't find that she's put out a book, but fingers crossed.
Okay, fingers crossed indeed. Well, that's great. Could we play out with a reading, as is our custom?
This is a reading of Mrs. Heaster's testimony about her murder. When her daughter died, she was certain that her husband had murdered the young woman. There were just too many red flags about how her neck was broken and how he dressed the body and wouldn't let anybody near to the body so that it just seemed as though there was something terrible about the whole situation. So this is part of her testimony. I prayed to the Lord that she might come back and tell me what had happened. And I prayed that she might come herself and tell on him. Do you think you actually saw her in flesh and blood? Yes, sir, I do. I told them the very dress that she was killed in. And when she went to leave me, she turned her head completely around and looked at me like she wanted me to know all about it. When she came, did you touch her? Yes, sir. I got up on my elbows and reached out a little further as I wanted to see if people came in their coffins, and I saw it was light in the house. It was not a lamp light. I wanted to see if there was a coffin, but there was not. She was just like she was when she left this world.
You've been listening to Bogart and Banshee, a supernatural podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please leave a review, as it helps other people find us. Those cursed algorithms.